Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Malcolm John. Malcolm is the founder of Action for Trustee Racial Diversity. He was previously the external funding manager for Harrow Council, and before that, he was, for 5 years, social policy advisor to National Grid Transco, advising on community investment and corporate social responsibility. Malcolm has supported and served as trustee or advisor for many nonprofit organizations, including the Young Harrow Foundation, Anti-Slavery International, St. Christopher's Fellowship, NACRO, Novus Scarman Group, and PATH National. Hi, Malcolm. Thank you so much for coming on Tolerable Risk today. I'm really excited to have you on the show.
Hi, Sabrina. Yeah, I'm also really excited and very pleased to have an opportunity to talk about my work as well. So thanks for inviting me.
Awesome. So before we get started into talking about the Action for Trustee Racial Diversity, which I'm really excited about talking about today, and your other work that you're doing, tell us a little bit about yourself, Malcolm. How did you get into the third sector? How did you get into this line of work?
Thanks for good questions. And it's a relatively longish story, but I'll try and cut it short. Yeah, I've worked across sectors. I've worked in the British Civil Service. I've worked in the private sector. And I've also been a consultant. And I've worked for local authorities. So I've done various bits of work. And I guess when I was working as a civil servant, I was running a funding program, European Structural Funds, which actually supported charities in the sector, in East London, in fact, largely. And I guess that's when I first really got to know about charities, understand their work, and realize what value they were to civil society. So that's my first step into the charitable world. And then doing jobs working for, I worked for National Grid. They had a charitable foundation. And part of my role there was to develop their work with communities. So again, that involved traveling all over England, discovering places that I didn't know existed, and working with local charities to set up projects, which fitted National Grid's vision and mission for engaging with communities. And I guess I've actually worked as an employee in the sector. But on that journey, I was asked to join trustee boards. So I joined a trustee board of quite a large charity, probably almost 20 years ago. And since then, I've actually been on about 8 or 9 charity trustee boards. So I'm a bit of a serial trustee, but I've loved it. I've really enjoyed it. And it's given me a great insight into how the sector works and what the challenges and issues are for it. And then I guess in terms of how I started Action for Trustee Racial Diversity, I was on a charity which I joined about 10 years ago, and that was called Anti-Slavery International. So its job was to eradicate slavery across the globe. And so when I was leaving that charity, there were then no other Black or Asian people left on the board, which was pretty unacceptable for a charity with the mission that it had. And so I guess that's when I said that I would help them to recruit up to at least 3 more new Black and Asian trustees. So we specifically advertised that's what we wanted to do, and that we realized it was an issue for us because we weren't representative. And we went out and were successful in doing that. And it was whilst I was engaged in that, Sabrina, that I sort of picked up that the sector actually was pretty lacking in terms of proper representation. And I think under the figures, it did not reflect society in the UK. And there was a report done by the Charity Commission about 6 years ago now, called Taken on Trust, which revealed that only about 8% of charity trustees were from Black and Asian backgrounds. And the demographic for that population in the UK is 14%. So that's actually a 40% underrepresentation, which is enormous. And I had a bit of spare time, unusually at the time, so I thought I'd see what I could do. Hence, I started with.
That's such an interesting background that you have, Malcolm. I want to highlight, so the organization is called Action for Trustee Racial Diversity, and it's atrd.group. Is that correct? That's the website?
That is right, yes.
Okay, great. Absolutely. Yeah, and so you, as the founder of this group then, I mean, definitely the 40% underrepresentation, and I can only imagine, I don't know what the statistics are in the United States or in Australia or across Europe, but I can imagine they're probably quite similar. So when you founded this group, then what was the goal? What exactly does ATRD do now to address this issue?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. The first thing I think we did was I reached out to contacts within the sector to try and understand myself better what the issues and challenges were and why it was where it was. And what became really, really clear was that trustee boards were largely white, were largely older, were largely male, and were largely university educated. So that actually does not represent at all the population in England and Wales. So I tried to understand why that was, and it was clear that most charities and figures were probably 70% of charities recruit informally. So they therefore only go to those people who they know, who they feel comfortable with, and who they believe will make a good trustee. So that perpetuates the status quo. And that was a really big issue. So until charities start to recruit openly and more diversely, that the picture that we have now is not going to change. And so the first thing I thought I'd do was to try and bust that alibi and change that picture. So I said, what we need is to tell charities that actually a lot of Black and Asian individuals exist out there with skills and expertise and talents, and it's a wasted opportunity if they're not drawn into the sector onto trustee boards. So the first thing we actually did was we set a goal, and it only takes 10,000 new Black and Asian trustees to actually reach that 14% of representation. It's quite achievable. If you break it down to say there are actually 168,000 charities in the UK, which is a hell of a lot, and there are about 900,000 trustees. So 10,000 isn't a lot, but until people start to think of it in those terms and start to think about how achievable it is, then actually it won't happen. So I put out a picture, a vision there. And then we went on Google, went on search, and we searched ourselves for organizations, Black and Asian networks, who are out there in their hundreds, in their thousands, with members, with followers, with clients and customers. We've now got a database of over 500 Black an Asian network organization. So that means that if somebody says, well, actually, Malcolm, we can't find people, I said, well, actually, we found them ourselves, they exist, and here's our database, which we make available to charities for a small fee, a small donation. So I think that was the first thing. I think the next was about raising awareness. So it's just about, again, doing podcasts like this, where we talk to people about diversity and inclusion, about the issues, the barriers and challenges that people from Black and Asian backgrounds have in order to access trusteeships.
When you're talking about diversity and inclusion efforts, a lot of times one of the excuses is, well, you know, these people don't exist, right? I can't find them. I don't know where to look for them, or it's not the right fit. And I hate that one. That's just, you know, really blatantly judgmental. But finding they're out there. And you found all of those networks. That's brilliant. You had mentioned, though, when you were talking about they're overwhelmingly old, they're overwhelmingly white, they're overwhelmingly male, they're overwhelmingly university educated. But then you said, and that's who people think would make a good trustee. So in your experience, when we're talking about trustees of charities and nonprofits, what makes a good trustee?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Are the trustees there to ensure that the organization is well managed, that it's clear about its mission, it's got a clear vision, and that it fulfills its charitable objectives? It's also there to oversee the work of the CEO in particular. So I guess what makes a good trustee are trustees who can do that. But I feel that in order for trustees to be able to do that properly, efficiently and effectively, they must understand the needs of the people that they represent, who very largely are not like them. So for me, there's a huge gap in terms of who gets on trustee boards. Largely, it's people who are often retired, so you've got time. If you're a young Black or Asian person and you've got a full-time job, or you're a single parent, then actually trustee boards are not set up for you, because they generally have fixed times, fixed meetings, and often they don't even think about the support that people who are not like them might need to be effective trustees. Obviously, trustees, they've got to be able to listen, they've got to be able to challenge constructively, they've got to be able to contribute to the strategic objectives of the organization. So they need those skills, but not everyone needs the same skills. And the skills of people who live the issues, so whether it's a mental health charity, homelessness charity, unless there's a trustee on that board, or there's a way of representing those views on that board, then for me, I don't think the board is able to operate as effectively as it might.
That's a really good point about boards being able to understand the mission of whatever it is the organization that they're overseeing. And certainly if it's understanding something like mental health challenges, if it's understanding something like being a single parent, or if it's understanding something like having learning disabilities, you certainly want to have people who are going to be maybe not so much developing the strategy, but certainly approving the strategy and things like that. And also the fundraising aspects of boards. I can absolutely see that what you described there is going to make a good trustee. So what is the benefit then of having diversity on boards? Not necessarily just people who may have had the lived experience of the mission of the organization, but diversity in general. What's the benefit of that on boards?
Yeah, there hasn't actually been much research on the benefits of diversity in the charity sector. And I'm currently talking to people about doing some research around that, which is surprising because it's taken for granted within the sector that it's diverse, it's inclusive, but actually very often it's not. And a lot of people don't actually know what the benefits are. They might have a vague idea, but there's been nothing scientific about that. And so for me, it's about if you have people on board all the same, from the same background, same education, the same ethnicity, same experiences, then actually they're likely to think the same and about issues. They're therefore, what you don't get is a challenge on boards. What you don't get is the different perspectives on boards. And what you don't get is the perspective of somebody who's lived the issues of the board. So you need that better range of people on the board. And you get more creativity after doing that. You get better ideas. I mean, I think there was a McKinsey report, done a couple of reports now, on the private sector. So there's clear evidence in the private sector that diversity, it makes organizations much more productive, that they can innovate better, and they can find better solutions to issues that they face. So for me, those are the real benefits of diversity. There's no point having a board where people agree with each other, because actually that doesn't progress the organization, and that doesn't mean it can actually find a way of actually improving the work it's doing and providing a better service to the people that it supports.
Thank you for that. And you had mentioned earlier how it's really difficult for some of these more diverse or underrepresented groups to participate on boards. You talked about everything from just scheduling to a sense of what you said earlier, what makes a good trustee. So what are some suggestions that you have for organizations and boards? How can they change to attract more diverse and maybe underrepresented folks to be a trustee on their board?
Yeah, I feel the first thing that they need to do is to understand themselves, going back to your previous question, Sabrina, what diversity and inclusion actually mean, and again, the benefits of diversity and inclusion to them as an organization. Because unless they understand that properly, then what follows from that is going to be relatively inconsequential and a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. So I think that's the first thing. And I think they need to have an honest conversation about their understanding of diversity and inclusion. Because I think people are often afraid to say something in case it's the wrong thing. But actually, it's about being honest, because we all say the wrong thing, no matter how experienced we are. But it's having the space to want to learn what, in brackets, the right thing is, because it's not easy. So I think that's the first step. And I think once they at least know where they are in terms of thinking around diversity and inclusion, then I think it's about looking at the organization and looking at its strategy and looking at what it needs to be a better organization to serve its customers much better. So I think, for instance, if you're having a board meeting in the afternoon, welcome to retired afternoon time. So if you're working, you're a lawyer or you're engineer, you're working during the day. So there's no point recruiting somebody on a board who's got a full-time job and you're only having afternoon meetings. A lot of employers don't give time off for volunteering and for meetings. So you've got to think about how you can accommodate somebody who's got a full-time job during the day, how you accommodate that. So having board meetings that in the evening is a better way of doing that. So that's one thing. I think offering childcare support, offering meetings online to people who've got young children is a much better way of ensuring that people who are not your usual trustees engage and can attend board meetings. Offering support, offering a buddy on the board, so having an experienced trustee actually act as a buddy to a new trustee, so that they're not coming cold, that they have somebody they can talk to about the issue. I had a really interesting story of somebody who's on one of my networks, was on a board advisory group. And she saw the board agenda, and at the end was something called AOB. And she didn't have a clue what AOB actually meant, but I think she was a bit nervous about asking at the bond meeting what's AOB in case everything went sort of that was silly. So a buddy on the board would actually have spoken to her before about that and would have said AOB is any other business. But it's also about the board not having that sort of jargon. So thinking it through from somebody's perspective, and there's terminology like nominations committee, remuneration, AOB, which actually are not used in normal language. So it's about thinking about if you're not from that particular demographic on the board, use plain English in a way that other people can understand. So there are a lot of things that the boards can do. One, which with my campaign, particularly advocates, is don't just recruit one person from a diverse background. So don't just recruit one black, one Asian person, and then assume that the job is done, because that's about tokenism. And it won't change the dynamic on the board if there's any one person who thinks differently, because that one person may not be brave enough, you know, be confident enough to speak up and say, actually, we should be doing things in a different way. So I'm always saying, recruit two people, recruit three people, because that shows that you really want to make a difference to the way your board operates.
Oh, I think those are great suggestions, Malcolm. Those are all wonderful suggestions. And I'm going to pick up on two points. I mean, one, definitely I've heard from so many people who are new board members or aspiring board members. And one of the things that they are the most worried about is looking stupid. Just like you said, you know, I don't know what AOP means. And I've talked to people who are really intelligent lawyers and business people and engineers, like you were saying, but they get on a board and there's this sense of responsibility and they don't want to be the dumbest person in the room. And so they don't speak up or they just sit there quietly because they don't want to embarrass themselves. And I feel like your suggestion about having a buddy is great because it lets people warm up to the idea, get comfortable and really bring their great ideas and energy to the role. So that was a great one. You know, focusing on diversity and inclusion. And what you were saying is that some organizations are hesitant, some organizations are even fearful. So they're sort of operating from this position of fear instead of a position of looking at it as a really amazing opportunity. So because this podcast is about risk, and I wanted to bring you on today to talk about diversity in the third sector, and particularly diversity on boards, what are the risks to organizations if they aren't leaning into or embracing diversity on boards or diversity even among their leadership and staff? What are some of the risks, and how would you suggest organizations to start feeling more comfortable about getting into the diversity and inclusion area and feeling more confident and seeing the benefits that come out of it?
Yeah, I think the risks are to how they meet their mission. I think that is the key risk. If boards are not seen by the people they support as representative, as listening, then actually they're not performing. And it may well be that people they support, they lose confidence in the organization because of what they see. And I think that's really important. I think that if people don't talk openly about where they are on that diversity spectrum, that's always the elephant in the room. And that there may be some board members who feel very uneasy about where they are, but their peers don't seem to be talking about it, then for me, that goes against the whole team spirit of a board. I think the best organizations are those who work better as a team. So I think it's about having the boards all thinking, at least all thinking in the same way about diversity and inclusion, because if they don't, and there comes a time when they're making a decision about a key area, then actually they're going to find it really hard to reach consensus because they don't really understand why diversity and inclusion might be important. So I think the best way to try and manage that, I think, this is by acknowledging that you haven't got all the answers and acknowledging that you may well need to bring in people with specialist advice, expertise around EDI, who can actually open up a discussion with the board about the benefits and where they need to be on that diversity path.
That's great advice. I myself have been in conversations with managers and leadership. And when diversity and equity and inclusion come up, you get varying answers, right? I mean, you get some people that are very open, very vocal, will put things in writing, are very committed. And then you get others who say they're very committed, but are really hesitant to put anything in writing, which maybe for some, you know, because the fear of being held accountable to it, right? And I guess I can understand in one way you can't predict the future. So why put something like that in writing? But at the same time, I would say, well, look, if you don't meet your goal as stated, you can explain why. But what's the problem about putting that in writing? So I think some organizations may just be afraid of this concept of accountability around DEI. What would you say to them if that's really what's holding them back?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think the doubt went up from 2020 with the whole Black Lives Matter and the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd in the US. And organizations woke up to particularly to issues around race and where they were. And so a lot of them began to take positions on that, which has been great, and which roughly when I started actually for Trusty Racial Diversity. Well, in fact, I actually started just before then. So perhaps I saw the writing on the wall, but I started before then. So there is more of an open door, particularly with the larger charities. But I think it's worth reflecting that most charities in the UK are small. Most only often have one part-time member staff. They work largely with volunteers. So diversity inclusion often takes second place to things like the finances, recruiting volunteers, recruiting CEO, organizational issues. So I think that's worth bearing in mind, because people don't understand that EDI should be actually be integral to all these things. If you don't have an inclusive recruitment policy, you won't get good volunteers. You won't get a range of people applying to become a CEO. You won't get people who, once they come in, think this is a great organization, it's supporting me, and therefore they stay. So there are a lot of risks around not embedding EDI and not seeing it as a standalone issue where one person does it, might be in HR, it's their job, it doesn't concern the rest of the organization. So unless you understand it's a sense of what you do, then actually I think it is a huge risk. So long answer to a short question. And I think it's important that it's embedded in strategy and in the most of some sort of risk management framework. So it's important that actually it's identified there as a key risk, but that it's not a separate section. So if it's about delivery of the organization's operations, then actually you ensure that if you're delivering your services, you're delivering it in a way that meets the people you support. So it might be online, because people leave their kids at home. It might be at a time when people have to work, so therefore you may have to be flexible about when you deliver. So all these things, I think, have got to be enshrined in policies and procedures. Otherwise, as you say, I think it tends to get overlooked. Other things I've seen, setting up an EDI committee. So something which ensures that EDI stays on the agenda, perhaps recruiting a champion on the board who's not the Black or Asian trustee, because that then puts him in a pigeonhole. So best if it's the chair or the vice chair or a white trustee, because actually that shows that it's been seen as important and crucial, and it's not compartmentalized. But I think there are things that charities, I think, can do to ensure that the diversity and inclusion is all at the heart of everything that they do. Inclusion policies. So again, if you're coming in as a new trustee or a new member staff, you want to be reassured that if you're there for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, you're not just given an induction policy and said, this is what we do, and then go away and carry on. Every time somebody talks to you about your experiences, you're listened to, you're heard, and then it's acted upon. So if you say, well, actually, I can't attend the board meeting because I've got a work meeting, it's not just about parking that and the chair saying, well, that's unfortunate, but it's about saying, how can we support that? The chair's role, I think, is key, because they set the agenda. I'm just starting a new initiative by developing a pipeline of future Black and Asian chairs, because I expect that the figures around chairs are, in terms of ethnicity, significantly lower than trusteeships. And for me, unless the leaders change at the top, I don't think that real change will ever happen, because as I said, I think that's where the decisions are made. The chairs recruit CEOs and so on and so on and so on. So for me, I think that's quite an important initiative, which we're starting this year. So look forward to talking to you some change this year about how that's going, Sabrina.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd be happy to have you back to hear more about that. I think it's a good strategy too. I liked what you said. You were talking about how the majority of the organizations in the UK are small organizations, small staff, part-time staff, relying a lot on volunteers. But I would say with that statistic, that makes diversity on boards even more important, because that's then how you can showcase your commitment. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. It makes it more important, but it also makes it quite hard for small charities to think about doing it unless, again, going back to the lived experience thing, unless you actually have trustees on the board who have that lived experience, because they're the ones who are going to influence the way that the board thinks and decides. And I just think the whole discussion around lived experience is only just beginning. And again, largely, again, going back to the whole thing around leadership, you know, why would you, if you are an Oxbridge middle-class chair who's worked often in the corporate sector, even think about getting that lived experience if actually that's not your own experience. I guess you'd only think about it if there was something which made you think about it, which might be something external, or it may be perhaps a member of your own family has had an illness or has had a social issue. And that made you think about, actually, how can we reflect that on the board? But that's not always the case.
Yeah, absolutely. We know that there's a lot of talk about diversity and inclusion, but the question is there a lot of action? So if somebody is listening today and they see that their organization is moving in the right direction, but they see that there's still a lot of talk and not a lot of action, how would you advise them to make a business plan or a request for additional resources? And those resources may not be funds necessarily. It might just be staff time or volunteer time or some agenda time to focus on diversity and inclusion. And maybe for this answer, not just at the board level, but maybe at the organization level as well. What would be some compelling arguments that someone could put together for resourcing diversity and inclusion efforts?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I've been on boards where it started well. The discussion has been had that's around diversity and inclusion. And there's been a plan, or at least an outline plan. I think what's often deficient is that specific action plan. Just as you highlight, that needs resources. And I think the best way of getting that resource is actually by not saying it's an EDI issue, but it's by saying it's an organizational issue. And I think that's by acknowledging how, again, get back to what I said earlier about the integrity of EDI within the organization. So if you want a better, more effective board, then it's about making sure that diversity and inclusion procedure policies are supported on the board through having a budget which supports trustees for training and development, for instance. So if they identify they've got a need, the board will then pay for them to go on the training course. It might be resources to bring in an external EDI advisor, can talk to the board about how they should be thinking about this issue. So that costs money. If it's at operational level, it's about thinking how you might want to address your services to provide better, more efficient, inclusive service to your customers, to your beneficiaries, whatever you want to call them. So that could say, I think it's about building that into the budget. So for me, it's not about building a separate EDI budget, but it's about ensuring that the other budgets actually that they support inclusive policies and inclusive procedures. So I think for me, it's about that, which goes back to understanding what the benefits of diversity are. It advances the organization, and that from the external stakeholder perspective, in terms of the reputation and culture, is huge. And we're seeing it now with big organizations in England, where if there's bad news coverage around diversity and inclusion, then that could actually affect their funders, could affect their sponsors, and so it could have a really big impact on the organization. It's not easy. And always when times are sort of economic times, often the first budget people look at is the training budget, the development budget, is the EDI budget. So you can argue if there is no EDI budget and it's embedded in the other budgets, then actually there is some level of protection for it.
I really like that approach, because actually, as you were talking, I was thinking to myself, well, yeah, if you're putting a budget together for a project or a program and you have staff training, staff wellness, staff well-being, staff support on there, and it's a tight budget, that's the first thing that's going to get the red pen through it, exactly like you said. So I wonder if part of this is also having a good communications plan to your funders and donors about why this is important for the organization, why diversity is important for the organization, and why resourcing that is important for the organization, and making sure that that is a compelling argument as well. Because yeah, I mean, I've seen it myself where those are the things that, oh yeah, well, we wish we could do that, but we can't. So I liked your suggestion about really integrating it and building it into these other budgets. Number one is a way to protect it. And I fully agree with that. But also, I think on the flip side, it's a lot like risk awareness and risk identification and risk management. If it's built into the organizational culture, if it's built in to the organization's ways of working, then it is like breathing, right? It's more like the way the organization breathes instead of what color socks the organization wants to put on that day. I think that there's multiple benefits, not just protecting the resources in the budget, but also really integrating it into the identity of the organization.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree entirely. And it's almost a shame that EDI, it's seen as a specialist area, in fact, we can all be specialists in. And I know, you know, my interest, my so-called expertise, only started 3 years ago when I founded this campaign. Because before then, like a lot of other people, I saw it as being somebody else's responsibility, somebody else's remit. And it's only when I started this that I delved further into the issues and the challenges. My knowledge increased, my understanding increased, because I was talking to charities about the issues that they face. I was talking to aspiring Black or Asian trustees about the barriers and challenges that they face becoming trustees. And that just raised my eyes about where we were in terms of that. And I didn't think I'm an expert, but because I've been steeped in it over the last 3 years, I suspect I probably know as much about it as anybody who does 3 years working on a specific area. And I should mention that I produced a guide the year before last, which captured the first 18 months of my journey. And it's called From Here to Diversity, How to Recruit Black and Asian Charity Trustees. So it's available to download from our website. I was quite pleased that it came out, and hopefully it's a legacy that charities are able to follow as they travel on their own EDI journeys. So I just thought I'd give a quick plug for the guide as well.
Absolutely. We can add a link to that in the show notes so everybody can have access to that and download it. So let me ask a very specific question then. For people who are currently trustees or board members of charities or nonprofits, what, Malcolm, would you suggest could be three questions or pieces of information that board members in particular should be asking for or asking relating to diversity in the organizations that they are managing and overseeing?
Yeah, I've said to people who are looking to become trustees, one question is in terms of trying to find out what the red flags are. So what to look out for? And a really good question is to ask the whole thing about lived experience. So how does the board make sure that lived experience of people who need their services is represented on the board? And it's interesting to see how many boards are able to answer that question well. And the mechanism for doing it is perhaps having an advisory board where people from lived experience, they sit on that board, so it's fed into the main board, or actually having lived experience trustees on the board. So for me, I think that's a really big question. I think the other question is, how, if you're a young Black employed new trustee, how are you supported on the board? So is there a buddying scheme? Are you the only person who's from that background who's coming on the board? How will the board adapt to you and others coming on the board who are not from the conventional background of trustees? So I think there's three, I think, quite key questions that I think I would ask as a new trustee, which I would certainly recommend a relatively new trustee from whatever background coming onto the board to be asking.
Great. And then I think if people are current trustees now, they could ask a variation of those questions to their organizations and say, how are you incorporating lived experience into the program planning? And how are you ensuring that volunteers of these maybe underserved communities are also welcome? Things like that. Those could be great questions for current board members as well. So thank you for that suggestion. You were mentioning that there's not a lot of research about this area. And I will tell you something very similar in the risk area. There is not a lot of formalized academic research about risk in nonprofits either, which was something really shocking that I found, which is part of the reason why I started this podcast. Not that my podcast is academically rigorous in any sense, but at least it's starting to get information out there for the third sector, for the charity sector about risk and topics like we're talking about today. If people are listening to this and they want to learn more, they are really interested in this topic, can you give us some suggestions, free resources, low-cost resources, where people can learn more? Obviously, your website, again, atrd.group, the Action for Trustee Racial Diversity. What are some other resources that people can access, read about this, learn more about this? What do you read or listen to that keeps you up to date in this area?
Great. Thanks, Sabrina. Good question. Obviously, I can refer to my guide, which I mentioned earlier, and at the back of that guide, there's actually a bibliography of research which informed me, so I would certainly refer people to have a look at that. So some of the ones I'm going to mention now actually are already mentioned in that guide. But not quite a lot of stuff around on EDI, mainly because, as I said, it's taken a high profile over the last 3 years. There are umbrella bodies for charities. There's the National Council of Voluntary Organizations, which is an umbrella body for charities, and it has X thousand members. So they've got a website with pages on EDI, worth looking at that. There's the Association of Chief Executives of Voluntary Organizations, which again is a membership body for CEOs. So again, their website, and I've blogged on both of those websites around EDI. There's the Association of Chairs, which is the member body for chairs in England and Wales, and I'm actually a trustee of that. So I'll declare a vested interest there. And we hold webinars around EDI and their stuff on that website as well, around diversity. And there's smaller organizations like ATRD. Getting On Board is a good organization. We do a lot of webinars, a lot of events around diversity. They've been going for over 20 years and we work really closely with them. And they deal with the broader diversity issues, not just race. There's something called the Young Trustees Movement, which again started a few years ago. And they specifically look at the issues for young people between 18 and 30 becoming trustees. First, I'd certainly recommend them. There's a group called Beyond Suffrage, which specifically looks at young Black women into trusteeships. So again, it's worth looking at their website. So that gives, I think, a flavor really, of what's actually out there. LinkedIn, before I started this, I was not a LinkedIn aficionado at all because I felt I didn't need to. But through this, as a campaigner, it's worked really well for me. And in fact, our main funder is the Co-op Foundation, which is a corporate funder. And they actually approached me when they saw our posts on social media. So for me, it's been a good source. So a lot of posts around EDI on LinkedIn. There's a diversity and inclusion group on LinkedIn, which I've just joined as a source of advice and support. And there's also a UK charity trustees group on LinkedIn. So there's a lot of stuff around there. I think I'll finally end with the Charity Commission, which is the regulator. They've got a charity governance code, and I was involved in helping them to revise what's called an EDI principle of that code, which I was involved in a year or so ago, and even produced a short vox pop video as part of that, which may well be available on that website. There's a whole lot of stuff there, Sabrina. I hope that helped.
Those are a ton of great resources, and we will do our best to get links to all of them, and we'll put them in the show notes for people who are interested. So thank you for that. Before we wrap up then, Malcolm, is there anything else that you want to share? Any parting words for people who are listening today about diversity in the third sector, diversity on boards, things that we talked about today? What would your parting wisdom and advice be for folks listening?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the two things to share is, one, it starts at the top. That's where the leadership starts from. So ensure that the top managers, top CEOs, top chairs, that they understand EDI and set the tone for the organization. The other thing is, it's not a quick fix. It takes time. And people often come to me and say, Malcolm, we're looking to recruit a couple of Black or Asian trustees. The deadline is 3 weeks' time. Can you help us? And I'm saying, if you're starting from where you're starting, you allow 3 months, 4 months to engage, attract people, and to ensure that when they come to you, they're joining an organization that's inclusive and welcoming. So I think those are my two top tips. The top leadership is really important, and allow time. Don't expect it change to happen in weeks or even in months.
I think those are great points. And I will say that both of those points equally apply to the risk area. I feel like with changing an organizational culture around diversity, changing an organizational culture around its approach to risk are slow moving, but hugely beneficial and hugely impactful. And again, tone at the top is really important, I think, for both of them. So those are great points. Thank you so much, Malcolm. If people want to reach out to you and learn more about you, learn more about the organization, learn more about the things we talked about today, how can people find you? Where can they get in touch?
Yeah, I'll be absolutely delighted if people reach out. And I've made very many contacts in the last few years. My life has changed enormously since then. But yeah, so Sabrina's already mentioned the website, which is atrd.group. Have a look at that as contact. We've got a ATRD Gmail, which is action4trusteeracialdiversity@gmail.com. And then there's my own personal email. They happen to get emails to markjohn18@gmail.com. And I thought I could contact it again through LinkedIn. So they're the four main avenues people want to get in touch. And I hope they do.
Great. So I'll put all that information in the show notes as well. So thank you so much for your time today, Malcolm. This has been such an interesting conversation, and I think really, really an important area for charities and nonprofits to be thinking about. So thank you.
Thanks, Sabrina. I really enjoyed it. I love talking about this work. As you can see, I've now got a new passion. I look forward to perhaps coming back and talking more about it and what progress we're making.
Great. Wonderful. Thanks, Malcolm. So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.